Christianity's most famous cold case detective wasn't always a believer. In fact, J. Warner Wallace spent the first 35 years of his life as a vocal atheist. His transformation from skeptic to Christian apologist began when he applied his professional investigative skills to the claims of the New Testament. As a decorated cold case homicide detective with a reputation for solving unsolvable cases, Wallace's conversion carries unique weight in apologetic circles. His methodical approach has made cold case Christianity a cornerstone text for believers and skeptics alike, with Lee Strobel calling it one of the most innovative and well-written apologetics books of this generation. What started as an attempt to debunk Christianity became the foundation of Wallace's second career as one of America's leading Christian casemakers. When investigating ancient claims like those in the Gospels, our philosophical presuppositions often determine our conclusions before we even examine the evidence. As a homicide detective with over two decades of experience, I've seen this phenomenon play out repeatedly in criminal investigations. At one particularly memorable crime scene, my veteran partner Alan immediately declared the husband was the killer based solely on his experience that spouses kill each other. He was completely wrong. The actual killer was a neighbor with a grudge who had carefully staged the scene to implicate the spouse. Alan's presupposition had colored his interpretation of the evidence so thoroughly that he missed crucial details pointing to an outside perpetrator. I approached Christianity with similar, deeply ingrained bias. Raised by an atheist detective father in the Star Trek generation, I believed science would eventually explain all mysteries naturally. Growing up, I was immersed in a worldview where technological advancement and scientific discovery were the answers to humanity's questions. My philosophical naturalism, the belief that only natural laws operate in the world, prevented me from considering supernatural explanations, even when evidence pointed in that direction. This mindset was reinforced through years of academic training and professional experience in law enforcement. This is precisely why courts instruct jurors to keep an open mind throughout the trial and not let bias, sympathy, prejudice, or public opinion influence your decision. The justice system recognizes how preconceptions can derail truth-seeking. While everyone has presuppositions shaped by their background, education, and experiences, the key question is whether we'll allow them to prevent objective examination of evidence. Just as detectives must sometimes set aside their initial theories to solve cases, investigators of faith claims must be willing to challenge their own assumptions. When investigating the claims of Christianity, I decided to suspend my naturalistic bias and follow the evidence wherever it led, applying the same forensic and analytical tools I used in criminal investigations. This doesn't mean rushing to supernatural explanations when natural ones aren't immediately apparent. That would simply be replacing one bias with another. It simply means being open to all possibilities, including the existence of a creator who might occasionally intervene in his creation through miracles. This approach requires intellectual humility and a willingness to admit that our existing frameworks might be insufficient. The distinction between science and scientism is crucial. Science examines natural phenomena systematically, while scientism refuses to consider anything but natural causes. Science itself makes no claims about supernatural reality. It simply provides methods for studying the natural world. When we encounter phenomena that can't be explained naturally, intellectual honesty requires us to consider all possibilities, even supernatural ones. This is not about abandoning scientific rigor, but rather about acknowledging its proper scope and limitations. In my experience as a detective, the most challenging cases were often solved only when investigators were willing to look beyond their initial assumptions and consider alternative explanations. The same principle applies to investigating historical and religious claims. True objectivity means being open to evidence that might challenge our worldview, whether we're examining a crime scene or the claims of ancient texts. Detectives don't rely on direct evidence alone. They employ abductive reasoning to infer the most reasonable explanation from available evidence. This method differs from both deductive reasoning, which proceeds from general principles to specific conclusions, and inductive reasoning, which moves from specific observations to general principles. Instead, abductive reasoning seeks the simplest and most likely explanation that accounts for all known facts. Consider a suspicious death investigation. When investigators find a young man face down with multiple stab wounds in his back, they systematically evaluate four possible explanations: natural death, accident, suicide, or homicide. While all might be technically possible, only homicide reasonably explains the totality of evidence: the position of the body, the nature and location of wounds, and the surrounding circumstances. The other explanations, while possible, require increasingly improbable scenarios to account for all the evidence. This investigative approach applies equally to historical investigations, including claims about Jesus of Nazareth. How can we explain the empty tomb and the disciples' transformation? Using the minimal facts approach developed by Dr. Gary Habermas, we can focus on four facts accepted by most scholars across the belief spectrum, including skeptical historians. 1. Jesus died by crucifixion under Pontius Pilate and was buried in a known tomb. 2. Jesus' tomb was found empty 3 days later, and neither Roman nor Jewish authorities ever produced his body despite strong motivation to do so. 3. Jesus' disciples, along with several skeptics and opponents, believed they encountered him alive after his death. 4. Jesus' disciples were radically transformed following their alleged resurrection encounters, shifting from hiding in fear to boldly proclaiming their message despite persecution. When examining possible naturalistic explanations, each theory reveals significant weaknesses. The survival theory, Jesus didn't actually die, fails to explain how a severely wounded man could appear triumphant and transformed. The stolen body theory can't account for the disciples' willingness to die for what they knew to be a lie. Mass hallucination contradicts known psychological principles about shared psychotic experiences. The imposter theory fails to explain how anyone could have convinced Jesus' closest followers. Legendary development doesn't account for the early dating of resurrection claims and the empty tomb. The resurrection hypothesis, while supernatural, actually requires fewer assumptions and better accounts for all the evidence. It explains both the empty tomb and the transformed lives of the disciples, including former skeptics like James and Paul. The primary obstacle to accepting this conclusion is often philosophical naturalism, the a priori rejection of supernatural explanations regardless of evidence. Without this philosophical bias, the resurrection emerges as the most reasonable inference, meeting key criteria for best explanations. It's feasible within its historical context, straightforward in its explanatory power, exhaustive in addressing all major facts, logical in its internal consistency, and superior to alternative theories. This demonstrates that faith isn't the opposite of reason, it's the opposite of unbelief. Biblical faith represents a well-placed and reasonable inference based on evidence, which is why Jesus himself directed people to examine the evidence of the miracles, John 14:11. This approach aligns with how we make many important decisions in life, from scientific hypotheses to criminal investigations, where we draw reasonable conclusions from available evidence without absolute certainty. Most people misunderstand circumstantial evidence, assuming it's inherently weaker than direct evidence. In reality, judges instruct jurors to make no qualitative distinction between the two. Some of my most successful cold case prosecutions relied entirely on circumstantial evidence. Imagine investigating a murder where the suspect, Ron Jacobson, owns the only yellow 1972 Karmann Ghia registered in the entire state, matching the getaway car description. He also owns rare boots matching footprints at the scene, a baseball bat with damage consistent with the murder weapon that's been suspiciously bleached, and jeans with unusual spot cleaning. While it's technically possible Ron is suffering from an unfortunate alignment of coincidences, it's not reasonable to believe this. This demonstrates how circumstantial evidence works. Individual pieces may have alternative explanations, but the cumulative case points to one reasonable conclusion beyond reasonable doubt. The same principle applies when examining evidence for God's existence. Consider four lines of circumstantial evidence. First, our universe had a beginning. Since anything beginning to exist requires a cause, and the universe began to exist, it must have a cause, one that's eternal and uncaused. God represents the most reasonable explanation for this first cause. Second, the universe appears remarkably fine-tuned for life, with precisely calibrated forces working together. Even the relationship between protons, neutrons, and electrons is calibrated to enable stable elements. This fine-tuning points to an intentional, supernatural creator rather than random coincidence. Third, biological systems display what scientists call specified complexity. DNA contains information guiding complex biological formation. And as Stephen Meyer argues, intelligence is the only known cause of complex, functionally integrated information processing systems. Fourth, we all recognize objective moral laws that transcend culture and time. In a purely natural world governed by chemical processes, free will becomes an illusion, making moral choice nonsensical. Only a transcendent being like God could provide the foundation for truly objective morality. Like our murder investigation, each piece of evidence might have alternative explanations, but the cumulative case makes God's existence the most reasonable conclusion. When assessing witness reliability in criminal cases, we consider four key questions. Were they present? Can they be corroborated? Are their statements accurate? Do they have ulterior motives? The apostles repeatedly emphasized their role as eyewitnesses, making it the foundation of their preaching. From Peter's first sermon at Pentecost, where he declared, "We are all witnesses," to their testimony before the Sanhedrin, where they insisted, "We cannot help speaking about what we have seen and heard," they consistently identified themselves as witnesses of everything he did. Based on my detective experience, reliable eyewitness statements typically share four characteristics that we find in the Gospels. First, they're perspectival. Each witness describes events from their unique viewpoint, sometimes creating apparent contradictions that must be pieced together. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John each provide distinct perspectives on the same events. Second, they're personal. Each witness uses their own language and focuses on details that matter to them. Mark's gospel is more passionate in its adjectives than the others, reflecting his personality. Third, they contain areas of agreement. Witnesses often describe dramatic events identically or simply affirm previous accounts. The gospels share many identical descriptions of key events. Fourth, later statements often fill in gaps left by earlier testimonies. John's later account clearly supplements details omitted by earlier writers. The Gospels display all these characteristics of genuine eyewitness testimony. Their apparent contradictions and idiosyncrasies aren't weaknesses, but strengths, precisely what we'd expect from true, reliable accounts. Additionally, the disciples witnessed events unlike anything they'd experienced before. While regular activities might blur together in memory, seeing someone walk on water or rise from the dead would be unforgettable. These unique, unrepeated, and powerful events created distinctive, personal, and reliable accounts. As a detective, I've learned to analyze suspect statements for subtle clues about their involvement in crimes. This forensic statement analysis examines word choices, tense shifts, and descriptions that often reveal more than the speaker intends. Applying these techniques to the Gospels reveals fascinating insights. For instance, John's consistent reference to Mary as Jesus' mother rather than using her name intrigued me. This makes sense when we consider that Jesus entrusted Mary to John at the crucifixion. Having adopted her as his mother, John likely felt uncomfortable using her formal name, preferring the familial designation he used in daily life. Mark's gospel provides even more compelling evidence. Early church leaders claimed it recorded Peter's eyewitness account, and forensic analysis supports this connection. Mark mentioned Peter more frequently than other gospel writers, used the most familiar versions of Peter's name, and positioned Peter as bookends in his narrative, the first disciple identified and the last mentioned. Mark also consistently portrayed Peter in the kindest possible way, even omitting embarrassing incidents found in other gospels. He excluded Peter's failed attempt to walk on water and provided edited, less embarrassing versions of Peter's mistakes. When Peter made embarrassing statements, Mark often attributed them to the disciples rather than naming Peter specifically. Mark included seemingly minor details that point to Peter's involvement, like mentioning Simon and his companions looking for Jesus during prayer, or uniquely referring to Capernaum as Jesus having come home, reasonable only from Peter's perspective, since Capernaum was Peter's hometown. These circumstantial facts about Mark's writing support the early church fathers' claims that Peter was Mark's primary source. By carefully analyzing the language of the text, we can verify historical claims about the gospel's authorship and reliability. Just as crime scenes contain both important evidence and unrelated artifacts, biblical texts contain both original eyewitness accounts and later additions. Detectives must evaluate what belongs to the crime and what doesn't. The same principles can be applied to evaluating biblical texts. Some passages in the Bible, like the story of the woman caught in adultery, John 8, 1-11, don't appear in the earliest manuscripts. Other examples include Luke 22, 43-44, Jesus sweating blood, John 5:4, angels stirring healing waters, and 1 John 5:7, Trinitarian formula. As an atheist, I use these textual artifacts to challenge Christians' faith in biblical reliability. However, I now understand that these variations don't invalidate the Bible's evidential value. Every crime scene contains artifacts. If I rejected explanations simply because artifacts existed alongside reliable evidence, I could never convict anyone. All ancient documents contain textual artifacts. If we reject Scripture for this reason, we must also reject Plato, Herodotus, Aristotle, and Homer, whose manuscripts are far less numerous and reliable. Importantly, textual criticism allows us to compare manuscripts to determine what belongs and what doesn't. Most textual additions appear to be scribes' efforts to clarify points, emphasize details, or add information known to them but omitted by the apostles. These changes typically have little effect on the narrative and virtually no impact on Christianity's important doctrinal claims. Think of biblical text like finding puzzle pieces mixed with unrelated items in a drawer. You can easily separate batteries and coins from puzzle pieces. You might even find pieces that don't match the puzzle you're assembling. But these don't invalidate the reliable pieces or change the resulting image. Even with a few missing pieces, you have enough information to recognize the subject. In my years investigating multiple suspect crimes, I've learned that successful conspiracies share several critical characteristics. They require a small number of conspirators, thorough and immediate communication between participants, a short time span, significant relational connections binding the conspirators together, and little or no pressure on those involved. As a former atheist, I always assumed the apostles' resurrection claim was a lie, an elaborate conspiracy to promote their cause. But my professional experience breaking conspiracy made me question this assumption. The apostles faced insurmountable challenges that would have made maintaining such a conspiracy virtually impossible. The Christian conspiracy would have required at least 12 conspirators, the apostles, possibly up to 500 eyewitnesses referenced by Paul. This number alone makes successful conspiracy highly improbable. Unlike suspects separated by just a hallway, the apostles were scattered across the Roman Empire, from Peter in Rome to Thomas in India. first century communication was painfully slow, making it impossible to coordinate their stories when interrogated. The apostles maintained their claims not for hours or days, but for decades. John survived nearly 60 years after the resurrection. Most conspirators can't maintain lies for even days. The apostles allegedly kept theirs intact for generations. Many disciples were strangers before following Jesus, coming from diverse backgrounds and communities. The short years together would pale compared to decades spent apart before their final interrogations. Most importantly, the apostles endured extreme persecution. According to historical accounts, each suffered unimaginable physical torture and died as martyrs. Peter crucified upside down in Rome, James killed by sword in Jerusalem, Thomas murdered by a mob in India. Despite pressure far greater than most criminals face, none of the 12 ever recanted their resurrection claims. While many people throughout history have died for beliefs they sincerely held, the apostles belong to a different category. We might die for what we mistakenly thought was true, but it's unreasonable to believe these men died for what they definitely knew was untrue if they had fabricated the resurrection story. As I examined the reliability of the gospel accounts, I faced a critical question. Were the authors actually present during Jesus' life, or were these accounts late fictional works? I had to determine if the Gospels were written early enough to be considered eyewitness testimony. Compelling circumstantial evidence forms a strong case for early dating of the Gospels. The most significant Jewish historical event of the first century was the destruction of Jerusalem's temple in AD 70. Though Jesus predicted this destruction, no New Testament document actually records it happening, a detail that would have powerfully corroborated Jesus' prediction had these documents been written after the event. Similarly, the 3-year Roman siege of Jerusalem is completely absent from all New Testament documents, despite providing powerful reference points for biblical passages addressing suffering. Luke wrote extensively about Paul and Peter in Acts, yet never mentioned their martyrdoms in Rome, AD 64 and 65, suggesting Luke wrote before these significant events occurred. In 1 Timothy 5:17-18, written around AD 63-64, Paul quotes two passages as scripture, one from Deuteronomy and one from Luke 10:7, "The worker deserves his wages." This indicates Luke's gospel was already circulating and accepted as scripture by this time. Luke admits he wasn't an eyewitness, but a historian collecting accounts from those who were. His gospel contains approximately 350 verses from Mark and 250 from Matthew, suggesting these accounts were already established and available to Luke before he wrote his gospel. Mark's gospel resembles a police crime broadcast, brief, less ordered than other gospels, and filled with action verbs and urgency. Like first responders who quickly gather essential details to broadcast before writing detailed reports, Mark focused on delivering critical information about Jesus' ministry with immediacy. The evidence points to Acts being written before AD 61-62, Luke's gospel predating Acts, and Paul's quotations from Luke placing Luke's account before AD 53-57. Since Luke quoted extensively from Mark and Matthew, these gospels must have existed even earlier. Mark's gospel, with its urgency and protective anonymity of key figures, reasonably dates to the late 40s or early 50s. This timeline places the gospel accounts within the lifetime of eyewitnesses who could verify their accuracy. The gospel accounts contain both internal evidence within the documents themselves and external evidence, independent sources verifying the claims. When examining the gospels forensically, the accounts fit together like puzzle pieces from independent eyewitnesses. When one gospel writer describes an event but omits a detail that raises questions, another gospel writer often unintentionally provides the answer. Beyond this internal consistency, ancient non-Christian writers reluctantly confirmed key facts about Jesus. Josephus described Jesus as a wise man with good conduct who was crucified under Pilate and whose disciples reported seeing him alive 3 days after his death. Tacitus confirmed that Christus suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of Pontius Pilatus. Thallus attempted to explain the darkness at Jesus' death as a solar eclipse. These reluctant admissions from hostile sources corroborate the gospel accounts. Archaeological discoveries have repeatedly confirmed biblical claims that critics once rejected as unhistorical. A 1961 limestone discovery in Caesarea bore an inscription with Pilate's name, confirming his existence and position. The pools of Bethesda and Siloam, once questioned by skeptics, have been excavated exactly as described in John's Gospel. First-century synagogues have been discovered in Magdala, precisely in the region described by the Gospels. A first-century fishing boat was recovered near Magdala, measuring 26.5 feet in length, large enough to hold 15 people, precisely matching the Gospel descriptions. The internal and external evidences work together to corroborate the Gospel narratives. Ancient non-biblical authors and archaeological discoveries confirm the broad strokes of Jesus' life and ministry, while the internal evidence provides the specific details. Our picture of Jesus becomes clearer as internal evidence authenticates external evidence, validating the claims of the Gospel writers themselves. Santiago Ortega, a cocaine-addicted bank robber I arrested, exemplifies a one-decision Christian. Someone who decided to trust Jesus for salvation, but never examined the evidence supporting his faith. When life's pressures mounted, his unsupported beliefs crumbled. My journey was the opposite. I investigated Christianity's claims before calling myself a Christian. Moving from belief that the Gospels were reliable to belief in what they claimed about Jesus required abandoning my naturalistic presuppositions. I assembled the cumulative case for gospel reliability, evaluating the apostles as eyewitnesses who passed every test. I remember the moment I surrendered my naturalistic biases and moved from intellectual assent to personal trust, much like an officer trusting his bulletproof vest. The apostles didn't die for opinions. They sacrificed themselves because they understood Jesus was the way, the truth, and the life. My conversion transformed me from a cynical, suspicious cop into someone with growing compassion and forgiveness. Making a second decision to defend what you believe is as crucial as the initial decision to believe. Like jurors who sometimes explain their verdict to reporters, Christians who decide to make a case for their beliefs grow in confidence and persuasive ability. You don't need to be an expert to defend Christianity, just as jurors don't need expertise to evaluate evidence and reach reasonable conclusions. Many Christians have neglected their duty as casemakers, becoming abbreviated Christians. While evangelicalism is understood as a spiritual gift that only some possess, Peter makes it clear that all Christians must be prepared to give an answer for their hope. Just as everyone needs to know how to prepare meals regardless of whether they're professional chefs, all Christians need to know how to defend their faith even if they're not professional apologists. I'm a Christian today for one reason. Christianity is true. I want to live according to truth, even when inconvenient or unpopular. Over 10 years, hundreds of thousands of readers have examined this evidence, and many are now Christians. The evidence does what it always does, demonstrates the truth of the resurrection and deity of Jesus.